I'm sitting here with Sharon Tate. Sharon Tate has traveled in the Wiminuche Wilderness extensively, as well as the Superstition Mountains in northern Arizona, packing and cooking for certain outfitters. Her knowledge of the area and certain Indians and whatnot is probably better than others of the area. So, Sharon, let's start with the Wiminuche Wilderness in the southwest. We find there's a lot of time there's not any water, and I realize there's water in the Wiminuche, and you might compare this with the superstitions and how you went about getting water and whatnot. Feel free to start wherever you like.
You want to know about the water and the superstition? We camped by the... There's only one all-year-round creek in the superstitions. Rebus Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And this old guy, Elijah Rebus, went up there in the 1800s and farmed. And he wanted to bring his wife. He wanted to bring her out to where there was an allergy-free climate. And she had asthma really bad and stuff. But she died before he could... when he went back to get her, she just wasn't well enough to make the trip. So then after she died, he was so brokenhearted that he just went there, and he was a hermit for about 38 years and had this a mule farm. And he'd truck his vegetables in, to Globe and Superior.
Uh-huh.
And he saved up enough money growing those vegetables, and that's why he camped there, is because Rebus Creek to irrigate with and stuff. And you could still see his fields up there. He saved enough money to leave money to his daughter out in California.
Now, the Superstition Mountains are north of Apache Junction?
They're east.
East of Apache Junction?
Well, yeah. They're just right in Apache Junction.
Which is part of the Phoenix
East of 50 area. Miles east of Phoenix.
Now, when you're taking outfitters up in this country, now you get water from this creek?
Yeah, we camp at Angel Springs, which there's pretty much year-round springs there.
Uh-huh.
We get water from there. There's deep pools you can swim in there. And down in frog tanks, down in Fish Creek, which goes out to Apache Lake.
What's a frog tank?
That's what we call it. I don't know. Frog. There's some tanks. All these contractors put these cement stock tanks in. When it was a working ranch, it was like three working ranches, one on either end, on three different ends. The Tortilla Ranch, the JF, and the IV Ranch,
mm-hmm.
and then that was their range.
And what filled these tanks?
The creeks. And
the creeks
and
would
rainwater.
Fill them, huh? But they would build these things up to catch this water.
They're just about cisterns, underground cisterns all over the place there, too.
But these tanks, they fed the cattle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when the cattle were out there.
And their own drinking water, or?
They didn't live out there,
but this was for the sake of their cattle, so that they
tanks,
could
herd
the cattle in this area. Now, this would be the lower superstitions, huh?
All over in the superstitions. Yeah, but the highest point is 6,200 feet. Next is Mound Mountain.
Uh-huh.
And Circle Stone is next to Mound Mountain.
Good enough. So as far as taking people up there on these trips and cooking for them... You had no problems with water. You never had to haul
kind
of water?
We had to plan our camps around where the water was.
Uh-huh.
There is another creek, too, and I'm not sure how long it runs. Because I wanted to, if I ever went down there again, I'd want to explore more of that other country, the northern part of the superstitions.
So this could be similar to these trips you've taken with Gunther Hart through northern Arizona, which started where?
At Mexican Springs, New Mexico.
And you rode to... Canyon de Chelly, Monument Valley, these areas. As far as water goes, what I know of this trip is you still had to follow where the water was. So I take it no one went out somewhere where there wasn't any water.
No, you can't.
Which was from windmill to windmill.
Yeah, you have to have water for the horses.
Uh-huh.
Mostly important. You could pack enough water for the people, but you have to have water for the horses.
So packing water can be quite a trick in itself, too.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to have to do that. I was going to say that, then I thought, well, I'll just let you tell your lie how you like it. Oh.
So, I want to start here in the real desert parts before we work up into the Weminooch. What do you think makes tourism so popular in the Arizona area? I understand that Gunther Hart, advertises in Europe and whatnot. What do you think makes the Southwest so attractive to foreign people or anybody not of the area?
Because of the fact that you can ride wide open spaces for hours all day long, where at home in Germany, they can't ride for more than 20 minutes without crossing a major highway. And it's so crowded that they have to have horses, license plates, tags on their horse, on the bridle.
Uh-huh.
And the Germans think it's great to ride across these open prairies, loping for 8 or 10 miles, and not see anything.
And how many miles do you ride a day when you take them?
30 to 40 miles a day.
Is this hard for them?
They're used to it. They know that they're coming for a long one. They come to ride. The Europeans have a different outlook on it than the Americans.
Which is?
Americans want to be leisurely. I don't think you'd catch one of them on a trip, on one of those trips. I really don't. They like scenery. And they're not just into the... This is like an endurance ride. Well, I mean, there's endurance rides around here, like around Navajo and stuff.
Do you know any of the Indian folklore of the Superstition Mountains or northern Arizona?
There's a lot of runes there, and Circle Stone, and the Salado Indians lived there. They were the pre-Anasazi, and there's cliff dwellings, and a lot of pictographs and stuff like that, hieroglyphics in different areas of the superstitions.
Mm-hmm. Now, on your Gunther Hart trip, which seems to be different than a Dobbin Shoups that you work for in the superstitions, in the Southwest, the trading posts, were very important, not only to the Indian, I don't like to use the word conquered, but if we did conquer them and got them somewhat civilized and got them into this capitalistic type situation, the trading post became a very important outlet for them. And now you started your trip in, with Gunther Hart, you leave where?
The Mexican Springs Trading Post. Mexican Springs, Bacaldita Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the oldest trading posts in New Mexico.
Do you know anything else about it other than that? But this is where you started. This is where the Europeans in this trip or whoever hired on, as a client started.
Yeah.
And, I was with you that one time and kind of curious, all the Indians that were around that still use this trading post, and this is 1992 now. Also realized that there was times when you resupplied with food, like in Canyon, not Canyon de Chelly, but Chinle, which is nearby, which is now a big supermarket, but this used to be a major trading post area.
And it was too bad that old trading post was closed there at Canyon de Chelly.
What do you know about it?
Nothing.
What about the one where you start?
It's probably over 100 years old, at least.
Could be.
If you leave them, the Indians will count two on you.
It's kind of curious, even in modern times, 1992, when you're doing the Gunther Hart trip, because I worked with you there, and we might call them modern-day trading posts, like the supermarket in Chinle, and I know that there was a very important trading post there in its time. Maybe it sat where the supermarket is now.
Well, where it was? It was on the way to the canyon. It was on that road to the canyon.
Oh, is it really?
Remember seeing it there? It's still there. It's closed.
And it's closed, but that was
like
the old trading post there, huh? How important do you find it? I mean, you got to get food and supplies, and most of it was food rather than... It's not like you were buying blankets or other tack.
Yeah. They were very because important at the time, because that was the only way that, you know, anybody got supplies. And, like, they'd have to wait till the next shipment came in, too. You couldn't just go to the store and get everything you wanted any old day. You know, they'd run out of stuff, and they'd have to wait till the next, till the traders brought more stuff, more supplies in.
Uh-huh. But today you'll find that it's still very important to know that, I mean, the trading post may have been a very simple form of civilization, if that's all there was. Even in 1991, you know, today's time period, you find it still important, even though when you're riding horses through the desert, to know that there is a trading post somewhere where you can resupply. What do you think you would do if there weren't any trading posts?
You'd have to just take enough stuff with you. You just have to be prepared. You have to know what you're getting into.
Therefore, you would have to pack three times as many horses as you pack before, because you got to carry it with you, huh?
Yeah. And if you didn't know where you're going to run into water, you could be in deep trouble.
Because you followed the windmills as such,
yeah,
from windmill to windmill, and this fed the horses. I realized that you actually did not use this for drinking water.
We got to some places where they wouldn't let our horses drink. We had to haul water to the lunch spots sometimes. Remember that?
Why wouldn't they do that?
Because the water was so scarce, or if the windmill was broken. This happened on this last trip.
Mm-hmm.
That they wouldn't even let us. They were chasing away all the wild horses from the windmill. They would
to let this water build back up? Or?
Yeah, well, they just had enough to feed their stock. And they were chasing away anything else. They wouldn't let our horses drink. They wouldn't let, you know, any wild horses come up. They'd chase them away. They'd have guards there at all hours, all day long, all night long, just to make sure that no other animals, nothing else use that water. People fight to the death over water out here.
Even today, don't they?
Yeah.
Even today, here in the town of Bayfield, because I'm familiar with Bicetal Lake and Pine River irrigation, you know, it's always a problem with water. You know, you've got a good year, you've got a dry year. And in the southwest, you know, in Arizona, then it gets much worse. Because we had the Salt River Project, which was a reclamation project, you know, which without it, Phoenix would not exist. You think this is these reclamation projects are a good thing? Believe we should be more like Indians.
They're living in a false reality, you know. A lot of them, they're depending on us for water. We're up here at the source. That's why the traders decided to follow the Rio Grande all the way up to the headwaters of the Rio Grande. That's why the Spanish window and the Rio Grande Pyramid, a landmark.
And this is where?
Up in the Wamanutch Wilderness. They followed
it. Okay, that's up there.
The Spaniards followed the Rio Grande all the way up from Taos, from Santa Fe,
mm-hmm,
all the way up to the headwaters. Now, to this day, there are still ditches that steal water from the western slope and divert it over to the eastern slope up there on Wamanutch Pass.
Uh-huh.
They steal water from the North Canyon, North Creek, and from the Pine.
Now, what is it like? What is it like? Because, you know, what you do for a living really is a primitive lifestyle. You know, compared to technology, you know, I don't know anything about the superstitions. If it's considered a wilderness area and you can't be driving a motorcycle up there, is this true?
No.
Just like the Wamanutch, they have
any wilderness, yeah.
Defined it as a wilderness area and same rules of the Wamanutch area.
Yeah, it's the Tonto Wilderness, all the superstitions up here.
So it must kind of take you back in time. In that you can't use modern conveniences. How do you feel about that?
I love it.
And would prefer to do that as a lifestyle?
Yeah, if I could live that way, if you could feasibly do it, you know, gather all your own food up there. And, well, you couldn't stay in the mountains all winter, though. You'd have to move down to the plains. You go up there.
Let's stay clear. Now, if in the Wamanutch, I understand this, you could not stay in the superstitions at 6,000 elevation?
It snows up there. It gets pretty cold in like December and January and February, and then it warms up. But you can still, we've been snowed on there in like the middle of February,
mm-hmm,
first couple trips. And even in March, and it'll rain and get real cold. The weather will really, you never know what to expect.
Well, tell me some stories of these kind of things. Let's start in the superstition area in northern Arizona, and we'll just work our way north. Because these are the three different areas that I know that you're familiar with. You know, the superstitions being southern Arizona, and then the Gunther Hart trip, we want to call that northern Arizona, when you travel through the Monument Valley and this kind of thing, always taking these people by horseback. And then Wiminuche, which is southwest Colorado. What would be the, in that kind of lifestyle, what would you find to be most threatened? What's the worst thing that could happen?
The weather. In the superstitions, you never know what to expect out of the weather. You always go in there not knowing whether or not you're going to make it out of there alive, whether or not. And then the people that are looking for the lost gold still, you know, the lost Dutchman mine, they'll shoot you if they think, and there's other mines too there. You'll get shot at if you get near their mines. You see these people, these survivalists there that, this one guy, one time we were going in, it was our last trip, and I was taking two ladies and a guy, and Donnie, the Wrangler, had taken the pack string on him to camp and left us at the lunch spot. Well, I went straight up one wash instead of taking the left. We'd passed this guy earlier, this camper, in full camouflage. His tent was right on the trail with two semi-automatics on each, one on each hip. And he just kind of stood there and stared at us. And so at lunch, he came walking up to us with a map. And I don't know how he knew we were there, because we were off the trail. We were sitting back up in the trees. And he could have gone either way, because there was horse tracks either way. But he knew. He walked right up to us and asked me where the closest water was. And I thought he was going to ambush me at the junction and take the horses. He could have easily killed us and taken the horses. There's a lot of scary people that just go there to hide out. The first JF ranch that we stay at, the first camp, this old ranch hand would live there for like 30 years. And two guys that had escaped from the army were hiding out, and they just needed horses and food. They killed him, took his mules, took all his food, buried him in the sand with $400 in his pocket, just so they could keep staying hidden out.
They took his money? Or they
didn't take his money. They didn't want money. They just needed supplies so they could keep staying out there.
Would money not have bought supplies?
They couldn't. They were AWOL from the army. They were, I forget what it was, but it was like when Bill Crater was running camps there.
Uh-huh.
And his guests found this old ranch hand buried in the sand wash right there in front of the farmhouse.
So he just took his supplies because he was out there,
yeah.
Maybe just like you folks, outfitting. You got lots of supplies.
That's no, yeah. That didn't,
a couple of renegades. Take a trip like yours and live for a month, because there's only two of them, or maybe you had supplies for what, a week, two weeks?
What I thought that he was going to do to us, you know. He could have just easily held us up, taken our horses, and gone on, you know, because he was afoot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was really scared. You get really scared down there. I wished I hadn't let Donnie go on ahead, because he had the guns, we didn't.
Yeah, I heard one story about the superstition. This was, you know, I don't know if it was in the 1800s or what, but because it would be the sacred mountains, what we'd like to call it, or whatnot, and the Spaniards were up there, and this is what the Lost Dutchman's about, right? It's Spaniard gold. Is this correct?
No.
Other than Indian gold?
No, Jacob Waltz, he was a German, or Dutch guy.
Oh, that's why they call it the Dutchman. Yeah. Okay, so, but it was not Indian gold, because what I gathered, the Indians had very little interest in gold.
No, it wasn't Indian gold.
So this one story I heard was that the Indians ambushed these, whoever it was. They had a lot of gold, which was in its crude form, you know, packed in saddles.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking it was Spaniards.
That happened up here. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I'm hearing about the superstitions. I don't know. And what they did is the Indians literally, you know, robbed and killed these guys and left the gold. They took all the silver conchos and things off their saddles and things, because they were more interested in the silver. Silver was a commodity to them, whereas gold was nothing.
Yeah.
It was just a rock. that silver was seemed to be a thing that the Navajos cherished.
They could work it.
And gold was meaningless to them. So they didn't realize how much riches were there.
Yeah, they did this here too in the HD Mountains. At a low crossing, that's where
the... And the HDs are...
They're southeast of Bayfield.
Uh-huh.
And they're... The Indians ambushed the Spaniards and cached their gold down here, supposedly at a low crossing in the HDs, so probably like further south towards Arbolins or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're back. And we're basically just, you know, talking about gold and other things that were valuable and what would happen. And I want to try to keep you in the south, further south yet. You know, but up here in the HDs. And when you travel with Gunther Hart, go ahead.
Well, another interesting story about the superstitions is there is still an Apache tribe that lives there. And this old lady comes out about every 2 years for supplies, just like lard, flour and stuff, salt. But they live there, hidden out somewhere in the superstitions, and they're wild enough to where it's believable. And I have a vague idea that they could possibly be in the northwestern part of the Tonto Wilderness.
But you've never seen them?
No. But somebody at a store up at First Water, mm-hmm. at the First Water store, saw this Indian lady. They've seen her come out, and then she, you know, kind of meanders back into where nobody can follow her. You know, she loses their trail.
Hmm.
They'll lose her trail.
Why do you suppose they do that? It's just
they're still living the way they always did, just, you know.
One of the last free Indians?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I saw this, and you probably saw it more, because I've done more trips with Gunther Hart. You know, I would drive between Flagstaff and here in Bayfield, Colorado. And I'd pick up an Indian hitchhiking and have me drop him off at Hell's Hole. There's nothing there. And I watch him walk across the fields. Where is he going? It wasn't until I took that trip with you and Gunther that I realized that these people lived out there. Maybe you've talked to more of them than me.
Well, working with Lorenzo, this Navajo guy that worked for Gunther too, I learned a lot about that I wouldn't have normally known.
Mm-hmm.
Running those trips, I mean, Lorenzo told me a lot about their culture, their folklore. His mother and sister were both weavers, and he showed me these rocks in this, I don't know what they are, they're feldspar or something, but you gather them, they're clear, and his mother and sister used them in their dyes to set the dye.
Uh-huh.
So I gathered a bunch of them. I'm anxious to try them out.
What kind of dye? Dye for their
the
weaving?
Wool. Yeah, the natural plant dyes for the weaving their rugs.
And these came from certain plants, and these stones did what?
They would set, you put the, add that in with the dye, and you're hooking up the dye with uh-huh. the plants to dye the wool, and it would set it somehow.
He
said they always threw, well, you always use like alum or some kind of a mordant,
mm-hmm.
or ash. Lye, you can burn, like, I've experimented with dyes quite a bit too, like juniper berry dye. I gather a bunch of them, and at different times of the year they'll put out a different color. I got green from these, but you can get a rust color too if you gather them when they're dried up.
Juniper berries, like what we have around here, huh?
Yeah, and they're down there too.
Now they always look to me as bluish gray.
Uh-huh, but you can get them, pick them a rust color when they're kind
of... Well, you pick them during that color, huh?
Yeah. Certain times of the year they'll put out a different color of dye. And like in the spring, you can gather mountain mahogany when the sap is rising in the roots,
uh-huh.
and it'll make a purple dye. You dig it up, just get the roots.
You know, I had learned that, back in the 1800s, early 1900s, you know, the white man had kind of exploited this craft of the Navajo Indian, which being, I tend to call it captured. You know, I don't know what I think about reservations and things, but... You know, at least once that they had been brought into this capitalistic way of life rather than their own, they were very adaptive, you know, to survive. And their rugs and things were exploited.
I remember when I was a child, the first time we went to Santa Fe when I was 8 years old, we stopped at these old trading posts because most of them were still running, you know. And this one lady had been given a month's worth of groceries for a rug that took her a year to make, and the trading post was selling it for $1,000. And all that poor woman had gotten was maybe $100 worth of groceries.
This was when?
This was when I was like 8 years old and 61 or so.
Mm-hmm. You know, they used to, actually, if I have this information right, they'd bring this. You know, they had the dyes that they made out of this stuff, and I don't know how they make dye now or how they did even in the early 1900s or late 1800s. But the white man would import dye to the reservations for the Indians to use.
Yeah.
So they could keep making these rugs. It was a real big deal. In fact, the rugs were more popular than the silver. Many times, you know, because we live in a tourist area and we have these little places that sell Indian things, but we're seeing a lot of jewelry and silver work. Whereas in the old times, that wasn't that big a deal. It was the rugs they really wanted.
Well, the Navajos have already always really been into the silver work, too.
Uh-huh.
Different tribes specialize in different...
They used to get our currency, you know, before we sandwiched it with the copper. You know, it was pure silver. And, well, we'd pay little medallions. But they had no use for these medallions. They'd melt it down and turn it into something else. Yeah, buttons was a big deal. But they really liked the silver for. I'd stop here as far as this interview goes. Besides Sharon's knowledge of the area, Sharon's also artisan in Indian crafts. She makes a lot of teepees. Sharon is a white woman. We find this ironic. But many of the Indians around here know her and commission her to build teepees for their ceremonies. Later on in this interview, we might get into the teepees. We'll stay to point and still talk about the travels. What kind of stories can you tell me about the Gunther Hart trip? We're here again.
Okay. Well, down in Canyon de Chelly, that's the highlight of that trip. We always spend a couple days, and we got a chance to drive through the canyon because Lorenzo was they thought he was a guide. So when we sent our guests on their truck tour, we would go just drive through the canyon. Lorenzo and I did that once, then Brad and Lorenzo and I did the second time. We got to see how the people are still living down there. The Navajos, they can go, and their land is passed down through their ancestry. Lorenzo's land was over in the White Mountains, but I guess he could have had it as much of a chance to have land down in Canyon de Chelly also. They raise goats and sheep down there for wool and crops still. They live pretty much the way they've always lived in hogans and stuff. It's really neat, really neat.
Ever spend any time in their hogans?
They gather a hogan is just, you know, the fire in the center and a hearthstone and pretty much how you'd see a house set up a room in a cliff dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a smoke hole in the roof. And we ran across some real old hogans made out of just cedar logs and stuff. And they're really an ideal structure for that climate, for that area, because they're cool and they're, you know, they just used what they had, adobes. They can make them out of adobe or out of logs and sod.
There is this two styles, isn't
yeah.
there? When they make them out of the logs, it becomes almost kind of octagonal because
mm-hmm.
they want to keep this round structure. Is there a reason they want it to be a round structure when a four-sided type building would be easier to produce?
A round structure is more in keeping with their beliefs, their spiritual beliefs, the energy,
mm-hmm.
like in a teepee, has the same energy as a pyramid. Even though a pyramid is square, but the way it comes to a point and its dimensions and everything has a lot of energy that they can capture in that space. And I think a round structure captures a lot more energy than a square one.
I suppose this is a culture from years ago. I've seen scientific proof of the pyramid, you know, and preserving fruit, this and that and whatnot. Indians must have other beliefs that go with their hogans and their teepees. The thing that you taught me is that the door must always face the east, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, face the place where the sun comes from.
And the reason being what?
Just, I guess, to greet the sun when it, meet the sun first thing in the morning. I don't know, it's just the way they believe.
Because they all do it. You can go to the sun dance, bear dances, mm-hmm. and the teepees are set up in the Ignacio area of southwest Colorado. and they do that. You know, because they seem to have this, it's Mother Earth. What would happen if you didn't set your teepee up that way amongst the Indians? Would they look down on you?
Yeah.
Or at least let you look, you're a foolish person?
In different tribes, or in Chaco Canyon, you know, the ruins, you could see one side. There's always one side, like the upper class and the lower class, the slums in Chaco Canyon.
Really? I didn't know that.
They built these ruins that fell down, that they built them real sloppy. Yeah, well, in any society, there's lazy people and there's, people that work harder, build things to last.
Okay, let's head north a little. In the Wiminooch, now in the Wiminooch area, I myself personally don't know any mountain utes. I only know the southern utes, but supposedly it was the mountain utes that hung out in the Wiminooch wilderness area where the mountain utes? And the southern utes were in this area where this interview is taking place right now.
Well, the Wiminooch Wilderness is named after the Wiminooch tribe. But I think pretty much all the Utes went to the mountains in the summer and came down to the plains in the winter. They'd go up to the mountains to hunt and gather berries and fish. And they didn't hunt in the summertime, excuse me, but they fished and they'd gather berries. All kinds of berries grow up there, raspberries, blueberries, currants, strawberries, just about any, squawberries, just everything they needed for, and all kinds of herbs for their teas and stuff. Flavoring, like OSHA.
Uh-huh. And do you yourself as a camp cook use some of these methods?
Oh yeah, I gather lots of mushrooms, berries.
Uh-huh. And what kind of berries do you find?
Blueberries, raspberries, strawberries. There's gooseberries, squawberries, stuff. Those are the kind they use in their pemmican. So they went up to the mountains in the summer to gather all that stuff, and then in the winter they'd follow the herds down to the plains.
Herds of
buffalo and deer, antelope.
Was this I don't know, was this area of Colorado, southwest, have buffalo?
I imagine. They did in the San Luis Valley. Cochetopa Pass means crossing of the buffalo.
Okay. But probably more than likely up in the high country. I could be wrong. It's very possible that buffalo was more of a plains animal.
Yeah, they weren't up in the mountains.
So your mountain utes, your Wiminooches, hunted deer, elk.
Down on the plains. The animals never had to go up. The big game never went to the mountains much. They've been pushed up there by civilization.
Is this right?
Yeah. They lived on the plains.
Because they act like human beings. There's no reason to be up there and starve to death in the wintertime. But we pushed them up because we've civilized the prime land.
They were just down here grazing on the plains.
Uh-huh.
The antelope especially, we could still see herds from before we lived over there in Swash.
Now, of course, in southwest Colorado, which is still part of the southwest, we've got a lot more water, don't we?
Yeah, we're up here at the source.
Ridden with you up into the Wiminooch, and it's just abundant with water. So therefore, you don't need to pack water. I know you haven't had any problems, and I haven't had any problems drinking that water fresh out of the stream. Have other people,
a lot of people that are, if they're worried about it, then I'll boil the water for them or put tablets in it or something. You could put a few drops of chlorine per gallon of water and let it aerate out, and it'll be purified.
And what's it like packing up? What is it like traveling by horseback in the Wiminuche area compared to northern Arizona or the superstitions in southern Arizona?
The superstitions are a lot more rugged, real rocky, steeper. Really,
more rugged than the Wiminuche?
Oh, real rugged.
Uh-huh.
The Wiminuche is lush, green, a lot more green. There's pine trees, tall pine trees, oaks, hardwoods, hickories, everything in the superstitions way up high. Like, it's so neat because you ride from a contrast from the desert to the high mountains in one day up to the Rivas Ranch, which is 11 miles. You see this contrast going up to the tall pines. And these alligator junipers, that they're huge and they're pretty rare too. That's like one of the few places they grow in the world. It's up there in the superstitions.
What kind of junipers?
They're alligator junipers. Their bark looks like alligator skin.
And they still have the same kind of berries?
Mm-hmm. And they get huge, just real big like this. They're beautiful.
Huh. Of course, you know, they're not near as high as in the Wiminuche. Are you at 9,000 or so feet when you're traveling in the Wiminuche?
We camp.
Compared to the 6,000 some odd in the superstitions?
Well, we ride all the way up to 13 something, 11 something is where some of the passes are, and then you can hike up to, you know, 13, 14,000 feet. But the camps average anywhere from like 9,000 to our highest camp is like 10,300.
Uh-huh.
Up in Rock Creek Meadows.
Which is where?
It's up, you go up the Visita, 15 miles.
The Visita Creek?
Visita Creek. Follow by Cedar Creek up to Rock Creek.
This is about 15 miles.
Yes. And then you got Rock Creek, about 5 miles. Up to Rock Creek Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there you can either drop down into the Pine, I mean into Flint Creek, go to the Pine through Flint Creek, or go over Gunsight, drop down La Osa Creek, or go over, drop down Ute Creek, Middle Ute, you know, go out towards Creed that way.
And are the, and what made these trails exactly? You know, I know they're maintained, and you yourself have worked on trail contracts to maintain these trails. I don't know the word for this. Is it facetious? But you know, I want to say for the white man's entertainment.
These trails were there. These are trails.
Were these made by
the Indians? They were made by the game, and by early trappers. And
so these were actually always existing trails,
yeah,
and now are more maintained.
Yeah, there's very few really new trails. Most of them follow old game trails or old Indian trails.
Mm-hmm. And do you find these trails staying near the water?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's a curious thing, huh?
Yeah.
Game people, these trails will follow the water. Get away from water, you might have to get off a trail if you wanted to see a certain place.
Yeah.
I suspect. Is this true?
Yeah. Well, that's only at the very top of a mountain. There's hardly any place up there where you can get away from water for anything. There's just water everywhere.
Huh?
Yeah.
Now, if we revert back into the superstitions in northern Arizona.
You've got to carry water with you wherever you go.
Were there actual trails? In the superstitions there was, right? You had trails you followed?
Mm-hmm.
And was this the same deal?
You got to carry water, a canteen with you down there.
Mm-hmm.
But like we'd ride, you can always ride to, you never ride anywhere where you don't know that there's going to be water. But I mean, if you'd never been there before, then you know, it'd be a little trickier. Like one time I got stuck down in this terrible canyon because my boss sent me on this little errand or expedition to go find this camp that we were going to be riding out to. Find where it was, and we were going to be taking our guests out that way and then turn around and come back in out to the Ivy Ranch down by Apache Lake. Well, he explained to me how to go the way somebody had explained to him, but he had never been there and neither had I. So I rode, me and this mare just pre-rode it one day, and he says ride along like an hour and a half past the gate, past the second gate on the Rivas Road, and then head down where the country looks low, where it kind of opens up and where you could drop down. I could see the Ivy Ranch. We dropped down in this terrible canyon, and I thought we would never get out of there. Me and Carrot, this little green broke mare. And I said, Carrot, you and I, we really bonded that. I said, we're going to probably die down here. It was hot. There was no water. I was worried about her, that she, you know. Finally, we found some little potholes of water, though. That's one thing, you know, I got off and led her up over the steep hill, dropped down into this other little canyon, and then we finally found our way out, but it was pretty rough. We got into like a box canyon. We had to climb up over a ridge, and you know, and I was off for walking, leading her most of the way, because there was no way that we were going to go back up the way we'd come down either.
You know, the animal, especially the horse, you know, through movies and whatnot, the Indians always had horses, and any of us that study any history, we know the Spaniard introduced them to the horse. This must have been a real godsend to the Indian. How do you feel about horses?
I wouldn't do without them for traveling in the mountains or anywhere.
You know, their instinct seems to be uncanny. You know, that we could be a dumb human being and lost the trail, get a little slack on the rein, and it'll show the way home. Do you believe that's true?
Yeah. Yep. Especially a mule will insist on going back exactly the same way it came, following its, you know, step by step. You know, whether it was a terrible way to go or not, they will go back exactly the same way they came.
Do you think the Indian is better off today, or were better off before?
Definitely better off before.
How come?
When they could just hunt and gather, and there was enough for everybody, and they could live the way that they always lived, that they were meant to live, you know. And they were healthier. When you eat wild food, you're healthier. You know, hunt wild game and keep moving over the land instead of wearing it out in one spot.
Mm-hmm.
They kept moving, rotating it, was, you know.
Natural rotation, maybe,
yeah.
Rather than, even though they didn't realize this.
Yeah.
Because they had to follow the game. And the Navajos did get into agriculture. I don't know if this was white man introduced or what. But of course, you know, that's only, especially in the Southwest. Now, this part of the country, Southwest Colorado, you know, there's more fertile soil than what you're going to find in the Arizona country. So chances are, you know, they couldn't grow a crop on an area very long. Plus, chasing the game.
I'm going to go shoot some hoops in that field. All right.
See you, Phil. You know, maybe it was a godsend that it was just a natural thing to happen in a hunter-gatherer society. You know, it may have been a fortunate thing that they could not have real good agriculture, therefore the land being able to reclaim itself before they returned again, which could be several years, huh?
They knew where to go to get. That's what just their natural cycle, following where they would go to gather certain roots, certain berries, certain plants, certain game. And, you know, that's, they just kept moving in a cycle. And according to the Indians, everything went in a circle, in a wheel. That's why they had the medicine wheel. And they never wanted to put the wheel to use for their own good. Like,
mm-hmm.
As far as a vehicle or something, because they knew that it had dangerous powers, evil powers.
That's what you're saying, so that they knew
that
about
it would lead to their
the
doom.
Circle, the wheel,
that,
but
yeah.
It was more like a god that was not to be messed with.
It was their whole religion was centered around the medicine wheel, and the way that every person would look at things, whether they were a mouse person, a buffalo person, a bear person, an eagle person.
And where did they get these kind of names?
It came to them in visions.
Now, I've heard this thing, and this is true.
The white
then,
buffalo
huh?
of the north.
And how did they get this vision?
The white buffalo woman brought it down to him.
Who was what?
In a vision. They.
I mean, did they sleep? Did they sleep at night?
Some of them would go into like a coma, like you were telling me today. You were
just
in your dream, like okay, black elk. Well, mm-hmm. The medicine man would bring these visions. He was a medicine man, and when he was a little boy, he like went into a coma for 3 days. And during his coma, he was flying over the land, over his people, seeing his people. And he saw 200 years into the future what would happen to them, that they would be living in square grade houses.
Which we see now,
which is
don't
what,
we?
Yeah.
The teepee got foresighted all of a sudden, didn't it?
But their whole, as long as they didn't put the wheel to use. They just worshipped it, and their whole life went in a cycle, like the cycles of the water, the rain, the snow come down to the earth and evaporate. The cycles of following the land around the buffalo, living in a round house. And supposedly, when they made their when they learned how to make their teepees, a cottonwood tree taught them how to make. They made it, children would make wrap these leaves around. And the cottonwood tree taught them how to make their home by wrapping a leaf around. Cottonwood leaf.
I'm not familiar with the cottonwood leaf. It looks like what?
It's kind of like the same shape as the teepee when it's laying on the ground, a half circle.
And it's time to make their home, huh?
Yeah.
Because of a vision or insight? Or?
Well, that's just one of the stories they tell. Like, you know, the spider woman down in the Canyon de Chelly, she taught them how to weave. You saw Spider Woman rock. And they just have these different stories, teaching stories. That they pass down through the generations.
This is an interesting thing. I'm about to run out of tape on the other side, then we'll start talking about Indian culture and your particular craft making the teepee and what you know about it.